call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow. Ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow. Now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
What's going on, Z-Pack? It's your boy, ZDogMD. Okay, today's episode is really, really special because number one, it is eligible for continuing education credits if you're a Facebook supporter or a Patreon supporter at the $5 or more level. And instructions for those supporters will be in their supporter-only feeds. Now, that being said, today's episode is super duper special. And the reason is we have brought back Dr. Blair Duddy. He is a practicing pediatrician here in Las Vegas, one of our favorite doctors around, because he is actually walking the walk and not just talking the talk. He's not in an ivory tower somewhere. He's seeing kids every single day, and he is passionate. You may remember the clip we did with him called Curse of the Gifted, talking about the challenges and opportunities of taking care of highly intelligent, gifted children and how that can be just as hard as taking care of children with other special needs. Dr. Duddy is someone that we would trust with our children's lives, and Tom actually does. He's Tom's pediatrician for Tom's newborn, Kennedy, and he is just an amazing communicator, scientist, and one of the most caring people that I have ever met. Now, one of the things he's super passionate about is home births. This is a very controversial area. It's something where, you know, the natural medicine people will say, well, this is the best way to deliver a baby, and it's all about the experience and avoiding medicalization and C-sections and things like that. But what Dr. Duddy talks about in this episode are the serious downsides of home birth. And it's very important because he sees the complications here in Nevada where he practices. Now, one quick clarification on this episode. When Dr. Duddy talks about certified professional midwives, the qualifications and regulations around them vary from state to state. He's talking in specific about the regulatory environment in Nevada, which is very, very minimal for those practitioners as opposed to certified nurse midwives or obstetricians. So we would encourage you, if you're a certified professional midwife or direct entry midwife, leave in the comments what your training level is and if it's different in your state, say California, somewhere else. There are about 28 states that license these practitioners. So with that clarification, Dr. Blair Duddy is on the show. Dr. Duddy, welcome back, son.
Thank you so much. So I really appreciate the introduction. One of the things we talked about after I did the gifted piece is, you know, my professional life is really one-on-one with patients in the office. And so it was really neat to reach out to people outside of the one-on-one.
It's funny, like doctors came up to me when I was traveling doing talks, and they're like, you know, that thing you did with that Dr. Duddy guy, that was so helpful because now I have a way of looking at my patients. And I think that's what we're trying to do too on the show, is amplify the voice of people who are actually connecting on these issues correctly with patients and with other healthcare professionals.
So I'm here because it's a subject I feel passionate about. I do some medical leadership in town and sit on hospital boards. And so I've seen several cases of fairly bad outcomes for home deliveries, and there have been some deaths in town.
Here in Vegas.
Yeah. I've thought about this for a long time. I have an interesting origin story in that I was born at Stanford, actually, grew up in Sunnyvale.
Wait, origin story. So were you bitten by a radioactive stroke patient?
No, you get
hemiplegic when you get angry?
But, you know, my formative years were like the 70s in San Francisco Bay Area. So My mom was an early childhood educator. She ran a laboratory preschool staffed by high school and community college students. She was an early advocate of breastfeeding. Mm. We had a actual breast milk bank in our house.
What?
So with donor milk.
So just like a bunch of bags of milk?
Yeah, people would donate. People didn't, you know, there was no HIV, hepatitis testing, any of that stuff. Of course, this was before HIV. And back then, if a kid had, a baby had allergic colitis, it could be very dangerous. They didn't have these hydrolyzed formulas for them. And so donor milk could be incredibly important.
Interesting.
So we would have donor milk to give to, you know, one baby at a time that was in dire need of it.
You know what? You know what? Not to interrupt, but to interrupt because that's what I do because I have ADHD. I had a stool donor bank at my house. it was one of the earliest ones, and it was largely unintentional. Anyways, go on.
So, and she was an early breastfeeding advocate. She was part of something called the Nursing Mothers Council of Palo Alto, which actually predated La Leche League. And they didn't have like lactation consultant certification back then, or at least she didn't, but she was an early advocate because journey back circa 1970, the breastfeeding rate was like 20%. So that, as in that context, one of our greatest family friends was a woman named Lester Hazel, who circa 1969 wrote a salient book pushing back against the medicalization of birth called Common Sense Childbirth.
Wow.
So it's weird for me to talk against home birth now when this great family friend who was lovely and bright and caring, you know, has this, you know, well-known book about it. Now, to be honest, let's travel back to 1969. It was a different experience, right? There was... Dads weren't involved in the delivery room at all.
They would be outside smoking.
Right, exactly. Right. And the postpartum woman were put in like this giant ward with six beds, sharing one postpartum bathroom, and there was not breastfeeding, you know, advocacy or help. So they didn't have epidurals. And even in the caring for the baby side, they didn't have, you know, routine ultrasound. The monitoring wasn't the same. Neonatology was in its infancy. The first fellowship for neonatology was like 1975. You know, they didn't really have baby ventilators. So not only could you diagnose and treat less, but the experience was horrible. So even though, you know, I feel guilty sort of going against Lester, you know, if we traveled back to 1969, I understand the pushback. And so if it wasn't maybe for her and that kind of discussion, maybe we wouldn't have a much better birth experience today, which is much better. It's not exactly like home, but they try to, in the hospital room, the dads all have fold-out beds and they have lactation consultants typically full-time to help moms with nursing. So it's a different experience. And the way I look at it is, you know, if it wasn't for Lester, maybe the hospital experience wouldn't be better.
That's a wonderful history because we actually lose sight of that, that it really was a miserable clinical detached experience.
And it reminds me of like, you know, the organic people, you know, circa 1969, you know, baby food had literally table sugar in it. And if it wasn't people pushing towards organics, maybe we'd still have, you know, sugar in baby food. Now it's just, you know, on the labeling, carrots and water, that's all it is.
Right.
Now, of course, they go overboard and do things like frozen lemon juice for malignancy, which is obviously absurd. But, you know, the way I look at it, because again, I, you know, when thinking about talking about this subject, I felt kind of guilty because I'm throwing Lester under the bus a little bit because of I disagree with home birth strongly, which is why I'm here. Mm. And there's this natural, in other arenas, similarly, it's like pregnancy is not a disease. Don't treat it as a disease. Are the natural birth community. Mm. And, you know, the medicalization of a natural process. People have been delivering babies for millennia without hospitals. Why are we doing it? And so the difficulty is the one balance of the experience of the mom and the family being able to deliver at home in a more comfortable environment versus what is the risk of delivering at home. So although it's a normal, natural experience, when it goes off the rails and there's a problem, we need the baby out and now. And when I look at the whole situation, I feel I come strongly down in the it's safest to be delivered in the hospital.
Okay, this is very, very helpful, I think, for a lot of people, a lot of mothers, a lot of parents, a lot of dads who are on the fence about this. Like, is this a good idea? I can tell you this, I'm with you on this. And the reason is that we see the complications of birth. So they talk about, like you said, medicalizing pregnancy, turning it into a disease is not a great idea. Yes, this is true. However, if you are, if you have a bad outcome at home, That is a vastly different scenario than something like that happening in a hospital. And since we see that, you know, my wife and I, both times she delivered in the hospital, but both times we wanted to get the heck out of there as quickly as we could when we were done. Because of what you say, it's more comfortable at home. Home is really where you're, it's a cliche, home is where the heart is. It's where you feel the most connected and at home, and you have a new baby. You don't want to be in a weird clinical environment. At the same time, we're deeply grateful for the care that we got. And that, and I want to put one coda on that, which is we suck still in this country at maternal care compared to the rest of the developed world. And so we can do a lot better. We're not perfect. We need to be very humble and continue to improve our quality. But that doesn't mean you throw literally the baby out with the bathwater on this.
Yeah, I agree. And there's a larger discussion of why our numbers are so poor for maternal mortality. Mm. But, you know, I feel, again, as a pediatrician, there's not the direct conflict of interest. You know, I see babies, whether they were born at home, C-section, vaginal delivery. And so my perspective is I want a healthy baby and a healthy mom.
Your dog in the fight is healthy babies, not, right. You get paid to deliver them by whatever
right.
means. Yeah,
absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah.
And one of the things that the public doesn't realize is I'm anti-home birth. I'm not anti-midwife. And
explain that.
So midwives in the U.S., we have several classifications of them. In Europe, an international standards for midwifery would be the equivalent of a certified nurse midwife here. So that's bachelor's degree typically in science or bachelor of science of nursing. Plus, so after RN, typically 2 years, like they're getting a master's in midwifery. They practice typically mostly at hospitals and birthing centers. They don't do that many home deliveries. Mm. Most home deliveries are done by something, designation called certified professional midwives or CPNs. Mm. And they used to be known as sort of lay or direct entry midwives. And they actually, they don't have in the same sphere of training. So it's high school only, plus basically an apprenticeship with 60 deliveries total, 20 are observational. They do some didactics and they should be NRP certified. So they're the ones doing a lot of these home births, and they're really, they're out of their depth by a mile. And this is their life's passion. They, you know, when a delivery is at home and goes great, it's, you know, it's magical. But they're really out of their depth. And I know that by criticizing their level of education, you know, I'm throwing them under the bus and they're going to be defensive. And I just urge them to really look at these numbers and the process and just get trained, become a certified nurse midwife. That's great. But they're really not, they don't have the training that I believe is really necessary to properly handle these babies.
There's a lot here, and I think, and I'm learning this for the first time.
Right.
So you're teaching me about this. And so it sounds to me like there's a potential here for not knowing what you don't know, for not being mm-hmm. able to recognize problems at home that a more trained midwife or an obstetrician would be able to recognize, and that leading to trouble. Now, the question is, if you're going to make a statement like that, the question is there data to show that these home births have worse outcomes?
There is a lot. So the two things we worry about most, you know, death, and that's significantly higher. And significantly higher is a debatable statistic, and I'll talk about that in a second. And then hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy, so a hypoxic brain injury. And so
the starved for oxygen, brain gets damaged.
Yeah.
And cerebral palsy.
They can have permanent brain damage.
Yeah.
And so the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American College of OBGYN have a position statement on home delivery that they came out, I don't know, 5 years-ish ago. And basically, you know, we don't want to be too paternal. That one of the principal ethics is patient choice and things in their care. But we want to be very clear what we think is relatively safe delivery. It's not as safe as a home delivery. A home delivery is not as safe as a hospital delivery, but if you're going to do home delivery, we want these characteristics. We want a singleton, i.e. not twins, normal presentation, not breech. You need to have people able to resuscitate the baby, and so you need one for baby, one for mom. And
how do you do that at home?
Pardon? The midwives will do that. They'll get NRP certification, but remember, they're not nurses. So they can bag babies. So 90% of the time, or more, if you have a baby that's not breathing, you can use bag valve mask on room air and get them moving and resuscitated. However, sometimes you're going to need a volume expander or epinephrine, and they can't do that at home. They're not nurses. Mm. So they're not really able to resuscitate a baby in the way that we could in the hospital. Mm. So if you look at admits to hospital with hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy, there's a 44 times chance more that they were born at home versus a hospital. So the
wow.
Yeah, it's
44 times. Yeah.
And the increase, even under these, you know, low risk criteria, the mortality rate is going to be about 1 in 1,000 higher for home versus hospital delivery.
So let me see if I understand this statistically, because this is an elephant rider thing. So my rider is trying to process this rationally, and my elephant is feeling emotion around it. So for every home delivery you do, an extra baby per 1,000 births will die.
So what's interesting, when the AAP ACOG came out with this, there was a flame war in the journals, and someone's like, are you guys crazy? And the authors were like, well, with yes, it's a higher, but it's not that high, and we want to let them choose. We'll just present the data. So for hospital delivery, there's a 99.95% survival rate. For home delivery, it's 99.85%. See, that's good, but... Mm. Yeah, that's still 1 in 1,000.
Yeah, yeah,
so if you applied that to 4 million delivery cohort every year in the U.S., that'd be 4,000 extra deaths, which is, by the way, 2 times total U.S. childhood cancer deaths. So if you take all childhood cancer deaths, 0 to 18, you know, leukemia, brain, lymphoma, neuroblastoma, Wilms, osteosarcoma, blah, 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 add those up, multiply it by 2, that's how many deaths there would be if everyone was born at home under low risk.
You know, let's really put a... put a point on that. So you're saying 4,000 extra children, babies, are dying every year.
Would die if everyone was born at home. That's the 1 in 1,000
number
statistic and extrapolated. Yeah. So I don't think it's worth it versus the experience of home birth.
Right.
And the home birth advocates will say, well, there's medical complications that happen.
Right, hospital's a dangerous place.
Right, yeah. Excessive rate of C-sections,
right.
And other, you know, infections, et cetera. But, you know, I'm here in the end to say I don't think that it's worth it for any family.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's interesting is that one of the problems, we did a show on maternal mortality earlier last year, and one of the problems is we were sending women home without good follow-up, without close checking, and so as a result, you know, it's the home that was really a part of the problem, and also we don't have good protocols to actually keep an eye on mom. We tend to focus on baby, and a million different reasons. But that does, again, there are dangers in the hospital, but it sounds like the dangers at home, especially if you're in the hands of a practitioner who maybe doesn't have the higher level of training as a nurse midwife or an obstetrician, is more dangerous.
Yeah, and they do home midwife deliveries in Europe, but they're with the higher level trained. Some countries up to 20% are delivered at home. Now, again, my point is you're going to, at best, the world, WHO says like a 10% C-section rate is appropriate. I mean, if you're doing less than 10%, you're going to have deaths or morbidity, encephalopathy. That's at best. And so transfer rate ends up being, 10 to 20%. Their survival data is pretty close to the hospital in Europe. They have seamless systems. You have to make sure you're not too far away from medical care and are able to transport the baby. You know, I see that and I should listen to that. But I just, if I just look at one, again, looking at extrapolating data, if you look at one complication that can happen, which is cord prolapse. So if the umbilical cord... it basically loops out and pops out between like the baby's shoulder and the mom's symphysis pubis. And they, it's just basically the blood vessels are compressed. Mm-hmm. And as soon as that happens, the time clock starts to hypoxia and ultimately death, right? You need the baby out in minutes to half hour. And that's going to happen, not commonly, 0.2%, something like that. But again, if 0.2% of 4 million U.S. deliveries that occurs, out of hospital mortality in that situation is something like 40%. So if, again, you looked at large statistics, that would be, again, like 3,000 deaths, like 1.5 times total U.S. childhood cancer deaths, if you just for that complication of cord prolapse. Cord prolapse in the hospital is a scary thing. They often put mom in a different position, or someone has to, you know, glove and basically reach in and push the baby's head up to try to take the pressure off, and then they wheel them to the OR and do a stat emergent C-section.
Right, right. A great indication for C-section in
right,
that case.
Right.
So, you know, this has an emotional heft to it, because I remember when I started doing ZDog MD stuff, one of the first groups of fans that started following us were a group of mothers, all of whom had had, they had been really the sort of crunchy granola types and mm-hmm. the natural types, and they had had a home birth or attempted home birth and had had bad outcomes.
Right.
And their mission was to raise awareness about how underregulated and undertrained some of the home delivery,
right.
You were talking about the lower
the
level
CPMs,
training.
Yeah.
Yeah, and how they would tell the stories, and there was a picture of the mother postpartum holding a dead baby. And I remember actually crying, so reading this message. It was the first time I opened a Facebook message and I started crying, and I thought, you know, what am I missing in this? Because it seems natural. I'm actually an anti-interventionalist. Like I often say on the show that we do things to people instead of for them in medicine, and that we are part of the problem and we need to get better. However, I'm also a rationalist and believe in evidence. And when I see this and I hear the evidence, it has both an emotional motivation and a rational motivation. But what you said about Europe, we might be able to get there eventually, so it doesn't mean we throw it out.
Right.
But
so one of the things that's come to fore in OB world in the last 10 years is a laborist. So a physician that's just doing the night shift to help deliver babies that need to in the middle of the night. And the downside is it's not your regular OB that you knew for 9 months. The upside is it's someone that's there ready on the spot. And so all the hospitals, one of the metrics that they follow is unattended deliveries. So the baby come in and deliver without an OBGYN or midwife. And the numbers have gone to essentially zero. So what we need to do is make the hospitals more and more and more comfortable.
Yeah, comfortable.
And it feels like home as best as possible. And you have certified nurse midwives doing a ton of deliveries. And there's a hospitalist there, because if we need that baby out, they're there to do the surgery and get the baby out.
I'm biased. I'm a big fan of hospitalists in general, because I feel like the hospital's gotten so complex. It's very hard to be a primary care doc and a hospitalist and nail both of those things. However, there is that continuity issue. So it means that that hospitalist has to be in close cahoots with your primary, ideally.
Right.
But I think that's doable, and I'm with you on that. And I'm a big fan of trying to improve both quality and comfort in the hospital. When we gave birth, I remember, because we were quote unquote VIPs, something bad was going to happen,
right?
You know, two doctors, me and my wife, both work at Stanford, both delivering at Stanford. Everything's going to go wrong. Luckily, we went in with this attitude of we're going to stay under the radar. We're not going to request anything, and it worked great because people were in their routines. And what I found was it was comfortable, but not as comfortable as home.
Right.
Both me and my wife were dying to get home. We went home a little early,
right.
And that may have not been the best idea because the kid wasn't breastfeeding quite right.
Mm-hmm.
And we realized, well, when we ended up having to give formula, she was like, just drank the whole bottle. Mm-hmm. And then my wife was just racked with guilt for not being able to feed and was sort of lactation shamed and all that.
So, yeah, I mean, it might be time to talk about that. We're two men talking about the birth
we're
process.
We're mansplaining.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we are compassionate and empathetic, and we both have an N of two of kids and have been through that, and we can't know what it's like to grow a human being inside. So this birth experience thing is a big thing out there. And my point is that, yes, I can experience it, but you know, I'm more comfortable around talking about this because I've been a pediatrician now for 25 years. So I've been to 1,000 deliveries, many more thousand the first 24 hours of life. And I've seen the arc.
Hola.
Hello. This call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow. Ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow. Now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Of kids' lives. And I, you know, I want everyone's birth experience to be great, but it's one day out of the next 20,000, you're going to be the parent. And I just want a healthy baby, right? And that's the important thing. Mm-hmm. You know, when we took my daughter to kindergarten the first day, and Mrs. Parks had, I was sitting down with all the kids on the ground in front of her, and then the parents were standing in the back, and she was reading The Kissing Hand. Do you know that one?
Yeah.
So she's reading The Kissing Hand about the first day experience of the raccoon family. And
it's pronounced raccoon, by the way. Yeah.
And all the parents were trying to prevent themselves going from a mild cry to an open weep.
Yeah.
When you looked at them, you couldn't tell which ones was born at home versus C-section versus vaginal versus adopted. They all loved their kids, right? So the idea that you have to have this perfect birth experience or the long-term relationship isn't going to be right, it's just, in my view, not true at all. Yeah. And I think there's a lot of women that have that, you know, the famous mommy wars things that they have to do it the right way. They have to do it naturally or this way. And or if they don't breastfeed, they're worried, you know, that they're a terrible mom. And I see a lot of that. And it can trigger postpartum depression. You know, I think about that birth experience. I was just thinking, I had like an epiphany that it's a little bit like Pear syndrome. Have you heard of Pear syndrome?
I haven't. Teach me.
So it's not a DSM-5 diagnosis, but circa the 1980s, there were some psychologists that described these people that were traveling to Paris. They were a high amount of Japanese tourists, and they had such great expectations. Oh my gosh, I'm going to Paris. And when they got there, there was this disappointment. And for some of them, it triggered like psychiatric symptoms, delusions, et cetera.
Wow.
And so, I mean, postpartum psychosis is well known and certainly depression, but there's this whole vibe that you have to have this perfect delivery. You know, if I don't deliver this perfect way, or if I don't breastfeed, you know, plan on community college, not Harvard. and, you know, I support breastfeeding, of course, but for women that can't or don't want to, there's no reason to give them a big guilt trip, you know, especially in term babies. The preterm, the 32 weekers needed like a Dr. Daddy milk bank. But you know,
by the way, that doesn't sound creepy at all.
Yeah, it sounds so creepy. Can we cut this part of that?
No, that's staying in. Well, so actually what you're bringing up now is interesting, because I get a lot of messages from moms who are sitting on these Facebook groups.
Right.
And they are obsessing, and, you know, other mothers are shaming them, and then they go to the hospital, and then maybe there's an aggressive lactation consultant maybe the bedside manner is a little different, mm-hmm. and they're not really acknowledging the sense of insecurity and really are, you know, if you don't breastfeed, you're a bad mother and this kind of thing. And, you know, to some degree, I think my wife experienced a little of that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, to some degree, I think Tom might have gone through some of Tom directly, because he produces man milk, which is very high in no nutrients. It's high in pork rinds. So this idea that what you just said, I think, is so important. I almost want to clip that out and put it out as its own clip, because there's so much shame. And when you and you say it's not without consequence, you can trigger worsening.
Absolutely.
Was it Paris syndrome?
Paris syndrome, yeah, for the city of Paris, yeah.
Wow.
It's just the expectation.
By the way, it's pronounced Paris, just in case. You know, the two communists in the back there like to pronounce it correctly. They would actually kill me if I said Paris, because they would think I like the French. But one thing you were telling me before we even started this, why this matters, are death statistics. People don't understand statistics.
Right.
The causes of death for children are actually rather surprising.
Right. It's interesting. It enters the space that you guys have talked about, which is that for a lot of people, and they truthfully tend to be high SES types that are pushed.
What's SES? Sorry, I'm dumb.
Oh, socioeconomic status.
Oh,
yeah.
I've never abbreviated it like
yeah,
that.
Yeah. So
Logan is low SES, just so you
So they are, you know, pushing back against medicine, that food is medicine, and that that medical intervention is, you know, unnecessary and overdone. And so that gets to the, I'll just have a, you know, a healthy kid and not worry about vaccinating because my kids are healthy.
Right.
And that they're, you know, they're immune to infection. And as you've talked a lot, that's just not the truth. And what happens, of course, in the 1950s when the polio vaccine came out and everyone went to school with a kids with polio, the line to get the vaccine was like, you know, huge. Mm-hmm. So everyone got in line because they were, you know, around kids with polio. Now that we've been successful with the vaccines, there's not as many people that have a neighbor that's sick. I mean, I talked about that when I did the anti-vaccine piece, that we've eliminated bacterial meningitis in the under five crowd. And you just don't see kids with hearing aids anymore very often because, you know, one of the top three causes is eliminated. 10% of kids that got meningitis, it destroyed their eighth cranial nerve and they, you know, were left hearing impaired. So you just, in middle schools and elementary schools and high schools, you don't see kids with hearing aids anymore.
You know, and when we had Paul Offutt on the show, he was talking about even just varicella chickenpox.
Yeah,
10,000 admissions a year for chickenpox related complications.
Yep.
And now, you know, we're dropping that with the vaccine. You know,
I mean, the benefit of officially being old is I've seen...
Is there an official cutoff?
Yeah. I've seen kids die of bacterial meningitis. Mm. I've seen a bunch of chicken pox. In the early 90s, there was a measles outbreak in L.A. And so I've seen like seen 9 or 10 cases of measles.
Mm. Did you ever see Koplik spots?
No, they didn't have Koplik spots, the ones I saw.
Yeah.
But I saw one of a pregnant mom who almost died. She was in ICU.
Wow.
But anyway, these...
Measles kills 110,000 kids a year, people a year, still worldwide. Yeah,
and I don't know if we're going to show the graphic or not, but
we
one of the...
There it is.
All right. In 2015, I came across an article in the Pediatrics Journal. It was about morbidity and mortality of trauma worldwide, and... So they had World Health Organization data, this is circa 2008, on causes of death of children on, this is planet Earth, so it's going to be 20% developed world.
Yeah.
So number one is perinatal causes, so that's basically home birth. So that's prematurity, asphyxia, and sepsis.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, diarrheal diseases.
Mm-hmm. Pull it back, Logie.
Yeah, I need to look at it.
Yeah.
And diarrheal diseases, so, you know, that includes rotavirus.
Yeah.
I don't know. Offutt didn't talk about that. There's 100,000 kids a year die in India of rotavirus to this day.
100,000.
Yeah, they don't. 100,000. They don't give the vaccine because it's too expensive, evidently. It might be that I forget whether it needs to be refrigerated, whether there's some logistical issue. So, you know, by comparison, again, for morbidity, if you look at total childhood cancer deaths in the U.S., all cancers in children, about 2,000 a year. So that's 50 times the number of childhood cancer deaths in the U.S. Those kids die of just rotavirus. Before the vaccine, I would put like 3-4 kids a year in the hospital with it. Now we don't see it anymore.
But you know, this is the best part. The anti-vaccine industrial complex with the professional anti-vaxxers who I don't give a pass to because they're delusional and they're dangerous to children. I give a pass to parents who are struggling with the issue and are legitimately concerned and emotionally reacting. I don't give a pass to these people because they will attack someone like Paul Offutt for making a vaccine that saves untold lives, and they'll besmirch his reputation and this and that. And that's why he can take it. He's a tough guy. He was on the show. People were banging on the wall.
Right.
And prepare for that, Blair, because you know, it's fun. It's a badge of honor when that starts happening. But we just can't tolerate it anymore. You know?
Right. I mean, I feel like, you know, I can talk about this again because I'm a pediatrician, and if an OB does, they have a conflict of interest. Right. I really felt important.
Right.
And the other cause of death, so lower respiratory tract infection, that's pneumonia prevented by HIB and Prevnar vaccine. Mm. Malaria in certain malaria areas. What's the next one?
Congenital anomalies.
Yeah, so obviously that's birth defects, but even prenatally now, there's sometimes prenatal surgery, or if a kid has diaphragmatic hernia and they're born in the hospital, you can have immediate intervention and decrease mortality of that. So even that is helpful to be born in the hospital. Mm. Then what's next?
Yeah, it's for pretty much all the vaccines.
Pertussis,
HIV, AIDS, which is interesting.
Yeah, that's test moms, yeah. treat them, give babies AZT when they're born. So that's preventable.
Then you have meningitis, which is preventable.
Yeah, so like six of those and top tens are vaccine preventable infections.
Go to the next slide, Logan.
Child
mortality age 15 to 19.
So this is teenagers. So number one, like the N2, or similar to the U.S., is motor vehicle accidents and suicide. Some communities, it's homicide for number two. But number 11 cause of death of adolescents on planet Earth is maternal hemorrhage.
So adolescents giving birth and...
Yeah, and obviously only half can die of maternal hemorrhage.
Right.
I mean, so that's incredible. I mean, if you want to go back to the olden days, 1% of women used to die in childbirth, right?
This is what I love. You know, we need to be natural. We need to, you know, live like our ancestors did. Well, then you're going to have a short, brutish and painful life and a pretty quick death, because that's how most of our ancestors lived.
Yes. My daughter, my eighth grader, was doing a project or a paper on Mozart. And like, if you look at his family history, like he and a sibling are two of eight that survived. And then he had like five kids and two of them survived.
Right.
And these are mainly, you know, perinatal stuff and then vaccine preventable infections. So, I mean, on Earth, there's still like a dozen countries where 1% of women die in childbirth. And then what was it? The other graphic that's interesting, you're pro or against or whatever, it's number 14 cause of death.
Is like unsupervised abortion.
Have someone, you know, they're in the developed world and they're worried their dad's going to literally kill them if they have an abortion or are pregnant. And so they get someone else to do it who's non-medical, or they throw themselves downstairs or something terrible like that. And so anyway.
This is a real, this episode is a real feel-good hit of the summer, Blair.
Well, the feel good part of it is neonatology is incredible. In my career, I've seen these micropreemies have so much less morbidity. Mm. So in 1960, if you're a 1 kilogram baby at a 90% mortality rate, in 2000 you had a 90% survival.
Mm.
Right.
That's amazing.
It is. Yeah. It is.
And again, it's the medical advances, and we should celebrate
absolutely
them.
Yeah. One thing, you know, again, if you look at midwife data in Europe, their numbers, I mentioned their numbers are fairly close to hospital babies. So they do home delivery relatively successfully.
Right.
So I think that's important to look at. And I mentioned why, you know, it still makes me a little uncomfortable. Mm. In the U.S., nurse midwife's mortality rate is actually less than OBGYN, but that's because of selection bias, right? They're not doing
moms.
Right. They're not doing the high risk. They're not doing C-sections, right? And so you'll see like in the literature, people comparing things all the time, like, oh, their numbers are better, so we should have them do it. Well, they're not delivering a 500 gram, 24 week preemie that has 50 mLs of blood in their whole body.
Right.
Right.
And this isn't a slight against midwives. It's saying this is where, that's how you explain that statistic.
Right. Right. Because otherwise people say like, well, you know, the mortality rate in the operative theater or hospitals is much better than surgical centers. So we should like do our valve replacements in surgery centers because they have less deaths, right?
They select for the better,
right?
Safer patient. Here's a question. The Business of Being Born by Ricky Lake. I haven't seen it personally. What are your thoughts? A documentary about the OB industrial complex.
Right. I mean, it's frankly annoying to me. No, there, if you want to argue that again, the benefits of the experience and that versus like, are we over-medicalizing? What's the C-section rate? You know, but the whole business that the premise that it's just greedy doctors and hospitals just ticks me off, right? Because the truth is an OB gets about as much for their global fee for care as a midwife. And so like my son, my baby boy, who's now 18, was $2,500 for the global fee when he was born. So that's 9 months of care, plus the delivery, plus rounding in the hospital, you know, 1 or 2 days normal delivery, 2 to 4 days C-section, plus the 6 week follow-up. Typically they don't get paid more for C-section. So that's a fallacy. Like, oh, they just want to do C-sections because they make more. They'd rather not because they have fewer days to round. There's no post-op follow-up.
Right.
So you can call them medically wrong, but to call them greedy is just
wrong.
Yeah,
just
absolutely.
Straight wrong. Yeah.
They're following their passion. And by the way, you know, let's compare the certified professional midwives with their high school plus 60 deliveries versus OBGYN, as you know, is like 12 years after high school to be a board certified, you know, OBGYN. The medical years should count as like dog years because they're working 80-100 hours a week anyway.
Right,
the amount of training is not even comparable.
And a nurse midwife is on that spectrum closer to the OB.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And so, yeah, because I got a lot of people sent me messages about that documentary. They were either pro or con. And so, to me, here's a thought, and it's a little provocative. Isn't it the height of narcissism to want to value the experience of birth over the safety of the child and the mother?
Yeah, I believe that's true. And the extension of that is this phenomenon called free birth. Do you know about that?
Yeah, tell me about this.
So free birth is... You know,
like, hey, is that free birth? Turn it up, man. Lord, I was born a rambling man. Anyways, I remember those old KTEL records?
Yeah.
Greatest hits of the 60s, man. Free bird.
Yeah, I think there's a Z-Dog parody about free birth, right?
There will be.
So, free birth is, you know, don't put delivery is not a medical condition. Pregnancy is not a medical condition. It's really sacred. And it's it's the most important day of our life, bring a new family member in, and we want to do it by ourselves. So they are born with just the mom and the partner without any medical intervention, no midwife there. Mm. And with the advent of the internet, they have, of course, a support group for them, and, you know, they'll be like, trust the process, you know, they'll be egging them on, even when they'll sometimes live blog that, you know, it's been 5 days, rupture of membrane, there's meconium staining. So meconium is the, you know, 9 months of buildup, that's baby poop, it's really just slough cells, it's that early stuff that looks like tar. So if there's meconium, what that means is they've been hypoxic enough to lose anal sphincter tone, right?
Again, like Logan. Yeah. I like to throw him under the bus because he can't really respond. He's not mic'd. There's no camera on him.
Yeah. So it's super sad. That's the pinnacle of about the experience. And I just want a healthy mom and a healthy baby.
Words of advice for people who are considering home birth or who are getting ready to deliver. They're trying to come up with a birth plan. I mean, what would you tell them?
I'm not in favor of it, but you really need to look at the risk. I'd prefer you to deliver in a birth center with a certified nurse midwife or a hospital with a midwife. I think the future is, let's just kind of really work on making hospitals more comfortable, bugging moms less, like really coordinating. If someone's going to go change out the trash, let's do it in one visit. You know, my wife is very personal space kind of girl. Not like anyone like looks forward to, you know, cervical exams, but... Mm. You know, in the hospital, they're like my, you know, work brothers and sisters and stuff, and they're dedicated and kind, but they do it every day, and they may not realize some moms are just more sensitive. Mm. And so, you know, during her pregnancy, they would, you know, come in episodically and check her cervix, and they would say they're doing it, but like she wants to know why and how, and you know, so minimizing, you know, interventions. And you know, it's a process, and there's been lots of improvements, both in the neonatal side and also in the OB side. So, like, they don't do routine episiotomies. They found that that's not that helpful to prevent, you know, grade 4 tears. Mm. I remember when they started doing delayed cord clamping. And so now they wait till the pulse before they clamp the cord, and they wait till it stops pulsating. And as a pediatrician, I was kind of worried because it's a lot easier to deal with a anemic baby than a polycythemic baby. Yeah, after a crit of 65, you go from linear to nonlinear viscosity. And so you can have like stroke-like syndromes, and you can have hypoglycemia and worse jaundice, but it turned out to be better. That's the whole point. When anti-medical establishment talks about DES or
diethyl still best.
Yeah, or you know, some of the things that went off the rails. Yeah, we learned and we moved on. Science is a process, not an ideology, and that our goal is to get better and better, and you know, making the birth process, you know, having maybe a hospital floor that is just totally different than the others and really makes it as comfortable as possible. Right now, I'm used to the hospital, so to me, it was not a big deal. Mm-hmm. You know, my wife had one vaginal, one C-section. Our son was early and came out. He had a cord around his neck, which is common that they can kind of pull it off. But he got a little asphyxiated, low Apgars, needed resuscitation, was in the NICU the first week. So bonding was not possible. They couldn't do skin to skin, and nursing was hard. But, you know, if someone suggested to my wife that she loves our baby boy any less than anyone else who had the home delivery and had the, you know, had the skin to skin, there's going to be a mom fight, right? I mean, so...
Mom Fights was a reality show on TLC for a while.
Yeah, so I don't want to totally blow off the experience, but again, if the kid has brain damage due to hypoxia, unnecessary, that's a tragedy.
That's the bottom line. One thing I'm going to say in parting here is that these groups online, they're wonderful and they can be supportive, but at the same time, they can create stress, anxiety, shame, guilt, yep. depression. And I'm going to make a really stupid mansplaining analogy here on our way out. And it's this. When I, in 2003 or four, when I first became an attending, I finally had an income that qualified me to buy a car that didn't suck. So what did I do? I bought an Acura TL, the 2004 Acura TL, which was like 30 grand. And it was like the entry-level luxury car. And I was obsessed with this car. Why? Because I Googled the car. And there were these support groups online of mostly dudes going, bro, 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 did you get the 18-inch rims, bro? Because, oh, did you hear that sound that the engine sometimes makes? You should take it back to the dealer because if it makes this, any time makes a click noise once, they sold you a lemon. And I started getting this paranoid anxiety about this car, and I'd go to the dealer and I'd be like, you know, the leather has a tiny little imperfection right here. And I read online, someone else said that's a problem in your Ohio manufacturing plant. And I became insane about a thing that gets me from point A to point B. And I started obsessing about this thing until I finally let it go. I forget what happened. I got a ding. My first ding, I'm like, I'm out. I no longer care.
For some reason, it doesn't surprise me that you have a little OCD.
A little? Yeah. It was, oh man, I would whack, because you know, you're not supposed to trust anyone washing your car. Just like you don't trust an OB to do check your cervix. You don't, you know, you do it at home. You don't trust someone else to wash your car because they might put a scratch on it and they're going to want to intervene then. They're going to want to use the buffer and that's going to cause more harm. And the parallels are astounding.
I'm speechless.
so is most of the audience at this point. Any parting words? Because I think we did about 45 minutes, is perfect.
Well, again, you know, I'm really throwing negativity on these women that are doing the certified professional midwives. And, you know, it's hard because I know their heart is in the right place. They think they're doing the right thing. But it's just, it's not enough. They're beyond their depth. And I urge them if they want to, if that's their passion, to get the training so that they can train to the level that is safer for babies and families.
Guys, I want you to do me a favor, leave comments, leave suggestions, share this with people who are trying to learn about this. You can get the CME once we get it approved. I will leave a link for supporters on Patreon and on Facebook to do that. Dr. Duddy, I have learned a lot today from this because this is something that, again, has been on my radar for a long time, but I haven't directly spent a lot of time researching because we had our births in the hospital. Hearing it from you, someone who's been in the business for 25 years, not as an obstetrician, but as someone who cares about babies, someone who I personally trust, and someone who takes care of my friends and their babies, and I would trust with my child's life, I want to thank you for being on the show, and I hope you come on again.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, brother. We out.
So what I didn't tell you about...
Hey, it's Dr. Z. Thanks for getting through the whole episode. That's a huge accomplishment. And so at this point, I just got to ask you for a few favors because it just helps us so much if you leave a review on your favorite podcast platform and subscribe. It just really helps the algorithm to get this message out to others. The second thing is email me, hello@zdogmd.com. I get all these emails personally. I can't respond to them all, but I need to hear your voice because especially on podcast, we don't have a comment section. And I want to hear how this episode affected you, what you'd like to hear in the future, what you think we got wrong, what we think we got right, anything, or just say hi. So that's really powerful. And the third thing is, financially, it helps us a lot to support the show in any way you can. And if you go to zdogmd.com/supporters, you can join our supporter tribe on your favorite platform, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, wherever. What that will get you on those platforms is live shows with me that are exclusive for supporters. and access to our Zoom meetings where we talk about awakening realization and we share with each other our own experience. It's a powerful group effect. It's a community, really. And we support and love each other and share, again, through our own experience, how we're waking up. So, and that ripples out into systems, into transforming healthcare and education and government. So it really starts with us. So join us there if you can. Again, zdogmd.com/supporters. And I'm so grateful to have you with us.